This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode. Welcome to the Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. In this week's podcast, Russ Kinnell highlights 2020's highs and lows for funds. Ben Johnson shares the top ETF stories for 2020. Maria Bruno tells retirees what to look out for in 2021. Dan Kemp predicts investment themes for the new year. And Christine Benz outlines the pros and cons of investing apps. Let's get started. Susan Jabinski from Morningstar Inc. and Russ Kinnell from Morningstar Research Services round up the year in funds.
Hi, I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar. 2020 was a tumultuous year for fund investors. Joining me today to discuss some of the top headlines in the fund industry for the year is Russ Kinnell. Russ is Morningstar's Director of Manager Research and Editor of Morningstar Fund Investor. Hi, Russ. Thanks for being here today.
Hey, glad to be here.
So one story for the year would obviously be the ongoing dominance of growth stocks and the funds that invest in them, right?
Growth has been dominant over value for a very long stretch. But if anything, I probably would have guessed that the roles would reverse in 2020. Instead, it just got even more extreme. The gap between all of the typical growth fund up more than 30%, the typical value fund up 1% to 4%. So the most dramatic gap we've ever seen.
So Russ, what other fund categories outperformed and conversely underperformed in 2020?
It was kind of an unusual mix. This year, tech and gold were among the very best performers, which is really weird. You wouldn't expect those two to do well in the same environment. That's really uncommon. And then on the other hand, energy and utilities were among the worst hit, just as economically sensitive and value stocks in general were very unloved.
Now let's pivot over to fund flows. What did we see there in 2020?
This actually reminded me of the recession and bear market in 2008-09, where you saw a huge amount of money going into bond funds and a lot of money going out of equity funds. And that's what we saw again this year, even though obviously returns for most equity funds were far better than bond funds. But I think that safety had a lot of appeal. And of course, lots of investors lost their jobs in 2020. So from that perspective, it makes a lot of sense. If you lose your job, you're going to think about protecting your capital a little more. But I think it was really a dramatic outflows out of equity funds, even though once again, we had a really good year for equity funds.
Let's talk a little bit about managers in 2020. Specifically, did the fund industry see any significant manager changes announced during the year?
Two of the more vulnerable names, very long-time serving managers, already well past their retirement ages, announced their retirement. Dan Fuss of Loomis Sayles Bond, a multiple Bond Manager of the Year Award winner, who's done a really great job, announced he would be stepping down. And Richie Freeman of ClearBridge Aggressive Growth, who's someone, a very low turnover, semiconductor-heavy portfolio that he's run since its inception, I believe back in the 80s, is stepping down. And so it's really an end of an era there too.
And then what about managers and outperformance? Were there any big outperformers in 2020?
Morgan Stanley Institutional Growth had an insane year, up well over 100%. Absolutely crazy. It's always been a very volatile fund. It's a focused fund with heavy emphasis on FANGs and other social media kind of plays, but it had a lot of the huge winners that benefited from people switching to working at home. Stocks like Zoom, Square, as well as some of the FANGs. And so just an amazing blowout year for Morgan Stanley and Dennis Lynch.
And then on the flip side, were there any, you know, managers we think very highly of that maybe didn't have the best 2020?
PrimeCap, which, as you know, is one of the managers I like the most, in absolute terms was fine. They returned about a little more than 10%, but in relative terms, way behind the pack. And obviously that's unusual for a firm that has long been a great performer. And I think you can really see the story when you look at the industries. They've long had been a little overweight healthcare and a little underweight tech. And prior to 2020, both of those sectors were so great, it didn't really matter. But in 2020, tech really took off and left healthcare in the dust. So that was part of it. But then they do dabble a little in industrial stocks, and in particular, had a number of airline stocks. And of course, airlines are among the worst places to be as the world largely shut down on air travel due to COVID. So just sort of the industry mix really worked against them in 2020.
Well, Russ, thank you so much for the 2020 recap, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I'm Susan Jabinski for Morningstar. Thanks for tuning in.
6 days a week, we deliver the latest news for investors. Just say, Alexa, enable the Morningstar skill, or visit morningstar.com/Alexa.
Now, Ben Johnson from Morningstar Research Services shares top ETF stories with Susan Jabinski.
I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar. 2020 was a challenging year for investors. Joining me today to talk about the top ETF stories for the year is Ben Johnson, Ben's Morningstar's Director of Global Research. Hi, Ben. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
So let's kick things off by talking a little bit about flows to ETFs in 2020. How did they shape up?
Well, what we saw were tremendous flows into ETFs and to fixed income ETFs in particular. I would say that 2020 was a banner year for bond ETFs. We saw record flows in part stimulated by the fact that the US Fed stepped in and backstopped the bond market in the early part of the year. And as part of their program to do so, they acquired ETFs for the first time, used ETFs as an efficient tool to rake in this case, investment grade and sub-investment grade corporate bonds by buying some of the ETFs that invest in those corners of the marketplace and effectively support that segment of the market and ultimately the market more broadly. And what we saw is that after the Fed made the announcement that they were going to do so before buying a single share of a single bond ETF, the market responded and flows followed. And we saw absolutely tremendous record-breaking inflows into bond ETFs of all types and not just corporate bond ETFs.
So let's talk a little bit about the performance of ETFs in 2020, particularly during the bear market that we saw in the first half of the year.
What we saw with performance in the ETF universe really followed the performance of whatever the underlying was. I think it's important to remember that ETFs themselves are just a wrapper. They're just an investment vehicle, and they're an investment vehicle that offers investors very cost and very tax efficient exposure to a wide array of different corners of the market and different investment strategies from active to passive to in between. You can get access to gold, you can get access to emerging market small caps. So ultimately where markets went, ETFs followed. And what we saw this year, just given the market environment, is that they went all over the map. Now, during the course of the COVID-induced drawdown, you know, what we saw is that equity ETFs tended to get beaten up pretty badly. Fixed income ETFs held up relatively well. Gold ETFs in particular saw a tremendous amount of interest, much as they did coming out of the global financial crisis when investors were first worried that the world as we knew it was coming to an end. And then subsequently, we're looking to gold as a potential inflation hedge, given all of the various measures that the Fed in the US and other banks around the world had to take to step in and to backstop markets to keep things afloat.
Now, you've suggested that we've reached a tipping point in the balance between mutual funds and ETFs. How so?
Well, the evidence is clear, and it's clear in flows this year in particular, where we've seen hundreds of billions of dollars flowing into ETFs and hundreds of billions of dollars coming out of mutual funds. And I think investors increasingly are coming to the realization, as I described before, that ETFs aren't synonymous with any one thing in particular. They're not synonymous with indexing. They are merely a more efficient means of getting exposure to different corners of the market, different investment strategies. And I think if you look at what we've experienced over recent years, years of persistent, in some cases, very sizable taxable capital gains distributions from open-ended mutual funds, it's really put the relative tax efficiency of the ETF wrapper into ever greater, ever sharper focus. So I would say that a wider array of investors are coming to this recognition, beginning to use ETFs in their portfolio or using them in greater proportion to other investment vehicles within their portfolio. The other key point that we saw this year was a tipping point of sorts away from mutual funds, again, is a distribution vehicle, as a way of consuming strategies, as reflected in the launch of new actively managed non-transparent ETFs from the likes of American Century, Fidelity, and T. Rowe Price, who have taken some of their flagship strategies and are putting them now on a new chassis, bringing them to market in a format that is more readily accessible, more fee efficient, and more tax efficient than their open-ended mutual funds. We've recently heard the announcement of a number of asset managers, including Dimensional Fund Advisors, converting existing mutual funds to an ETF. In particular, Dimensional is looking to change six of its tax-managed mutual funds into ETFs in 2021. These are, in some cases, funds that have been spitting out taxable capital gains to their investors who are clearly tax-sensitive. They're investing in tax-managed strategies, the ETF is ultimately going to help shield them from having similar adverse experiences in the future. So I think we're going to continue to see more and more assets replatformed off of mutual funds and onto ETFs, and not just ETFs, I would argue. I would say the asset management industry and investors over the years have been moving away from mutual funds, not just towards ETFs in a taxable setting, but we've seen a similar trend away from mutual funds to things like collective investment trusts in the retirement space. So these are just newer formats, more investor-friendly formats, largely because they're less costly than their mutual fund predecessors. So ETFs are just, you know, one of the beneficiaries of what we've seen, which has been large and persistent outflows from mutual funds.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for your perspective on 2020, and Happy New Year to you.
Thanks, and Happy New Year to you too, Susan.
I'm Susan Jabinski for Morningstar. Thanks for tuning in.
Watch all the Morningstar content you love from your living room. Download the Morningstar Roku channel and get up-to-date independent insights on today's markets. Be comfortable. Be informed.
Next, Christine Benz from Morningstar Inc. interviews Maria Bruno from Vanguard.
Hi, I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar. What's changing about retirement planning for 2021? Joining me to discuss that topic is Maria Bruno. She's head of U.S. Wealth Planning Research for Vanguard. Maria, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Christine. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about 2021. 2020 for many retirees was kind of a funny year. We didn't have required minimum distributions. That was one of the big things. So we'll have a lot of people taking their required minimum distribution for the first time in 2021. What should those new RMD takers know?
Well, I think first and foremost is that the RMD age has changed. So it used to be 70 and a half, but it is now age 72. So you don't have to take a distribution until you turn 72. So in the year you turn 72, you are required to take that distribution by April 1st of the following year. So there's a little bit of flexibility in that first year. The other thing I would probably just reinforce is there's the cost of not taking the distribution is pretty significant. There's a 50% excise tax for the amount that you should have taken. So it is very important to make sure that if you are mandated to take the distribution, and again, the distributions are from traditional IRAs, 401ks, and Roth 401ks, although they are not taxed, still mandated to take withdrawals on an annual basis.
So definitely mark your calendar. You have until, 12/31 to take those distributions, right?
Absolutely, right. Okay. They're on a calendar year basis, except for the first year that you start taking them.
Okay. So let's talk about people who aren't yet subject to RMDs. So they're not yet 72 and they have some latitude to draw from potentially different accounts. How should they approach that question, deciding whether to go into taxable accounts or tax deferred accounts or even Roth accounts? How should they think about sourcing the cash flows that they'll need for retirement, especially in those pre-RMD years?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I often say the time to think about RMDs is not when you are 72 now, but actually quite before, and thinking about that as an asset pool. So I think there's, for those individuals who are withdrawing from their portfolio pre-RMD age, there's flexibility to think about, how do I minimize taxes both today and then potentially down the road? So if you do have flexibility in having taxable assets or tax deferred or Roth assets, you can be surgical on a year-by-year basis to think about, how can I minimize both the liability this year, but then also what I might be looking at during the, you know, in the future down the road. The reason I bring it up is because a lot of individuals are sitting on large deferred balances. And while there is a benefit to not touching those tax-deferred assets because you can continue to enjoy tax-deferred growth, some individuals, given the size of their IRA or 401k, can be subjected to pretty large mandated distributions, which would then, you know, pretty much come with what they call the tax torpedo. You have large tax liabilities. So potentially, you know, leading up to that age 72, you could start to withdraw from those assets. Yes, you are accelerating some tax liability, but hopefully at a presumably lower rate. And you're potentially also lowering future RMDs because the size of those IRAs are smaller. So my suggestion would be to put some thought into it to see whether it does make sense to actually tap those assets, or maybe even think about converting some of those assets to Roth IRAs, which are not subjected to lifetime distributions.
So potentially get some tax help here too, especially if people aren't super conversant in figuring this stuff out, because it gets complicated.
It can get complicated. With flexibility sometimes comes complication, but it really does provide some planning opportunities. So it is good to be thoughtful. It's also good to think about the interrelation between portfolio withdrawals and when to claim Social Security as well. There's some interplay. So it does, you know, it does maybe have some merit to having talked to a tax professional or a financial planner. Absolutely.
Okay. But you've written about those post-retirement pre-RMD years. You've called them the sweet spot because that's really where your planning opportunities are, right? You have
Absolutely.
Less control once those RMDs begin.
Exactly, because they're required distribution. So at that point, the levers that you have in your toolbox, there's not as many. So certainly be thoughtful. In terms of your options, it doesn't necessarily mean you need to do that or should, but it may vary year by year as well. But just make sure you think about your options during those years. Absolutely.
Okay. One looming question is whether we should expect to see big changes to the tax code, given that we've had the election, we'll have the changeover in the presidential administration. What's your advice to investors about how or whether to handicap those tax law changes ahead of time? Should they be preemptive in thinking about their portfolios? How should they approach that?
Yeah, we go through this with every change of administration when there's a concern or interest that there might be changes in tax legislation. We just don't know. There are proposals that are out there. We don't know exactly what will happen or when. So to make changes in your portfolio or maybe your drawdown strategies or gifting strategies with the uncertainty, it's good to have it in mind and maybe think about what could. But be careful about making transactions or executing on strategies that may be, something that you think could happen. Because the reality of it is we don't know when it'll happen or if it'll be retroactive to the beginning of the year. So for individuals who just aren't sure, maybe waiting till later in the year to see, you know, what clarity we might have around changes if they come into play and when, that could be an option as well. But I would just be careful, understand that we might have some changes, but to make changes today based upon what we think can happen, given the uncertainty around the timing of it or exactly what can happen, we don't know until it actually is legislation.
We've been talking about tax rates and withdrawals, but how about the actual withdrawal amount? Many retirees struggle with that, and of course, it's difficult to know what the right withdrawal amount is, but how's Vanguard thinking about that question? There's been a lot of debate about whether the 4% withdrawal guideline is outmoded, especially given how low yields are today. How would you urge investors to think about that?
Yeah, I think flexibility continues to be key. No retiree really is that prescriptive in terms of what they spend every year as with a very precise percentage. But when you look at what we think can happen in terms of our forecast, so Vanguard just released its economic forecast for the next decade or so. And when you look at global balanced portfolios, the return expectations are muted. You're looking at, at the median, maybe about a 4.5% nominal return if you consider inflation. That's probably closer to about 2.5-3%, and there's a wide distribution around that. So that's lower than what we've seen in the past. And year by year things may change, but I think the point there is to be more realistic in terms of what to expect out of market returns and to recalibrate your spending expectations there. That doesn't mean that the 4% rule is dead or anything like that, but just be mindful in terms of what conditions we're looking at today. And over the next couple of years, you might need to be a little bit mindful in terms of ratcheting back a bit. Many retirees probably do that to the extent that they can in terms of the years when market returns are higher. They might flex a little bit lower on their spending to give them more reserve in those situations where we're expecting a more muted outlook. So I think this is a situation where over the next couple of years, we might see more muted returns, maybe some volatility around that. So I would recommend just being careful in terms of what you're spending and adapt to that.
Good advice as always, Maria. You're always so practical and helpful. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for watching. I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar.
Now, Dan Kemp and Holly Black from Morningstar UK forecast 2021's investment themes.
Welcome to Morningstar. I'm Holly Black. With me is Dan Kemp. He's from Morningstar Investment Management. Hiya.
Hello, Holly.
So, Dan, it's that time of year where I'm writing my Christmas list, but I'm also taking stock of what happened in 2020 and thinking to the year ahead. So, three themes for the year ahead you've got for us. Where should we start?
Well, Holly, I think we have to start with value. That's a word on many people's lips at the moment. And it's for some been quite a dirty word in investment terms over the last couple of years because so-called value managers have performed pretty poorly. And that's because people become very enthusiastic about growth stocks, technology stocks, so-called working from home stocks, that are expected to benefit from the current environment. So these were already expensive coming into the pandemic, and really the pandemic has just heightened the price of some of these growth technology working from home stocks. So what we see at the moment is an incredible bifurcation between value and growth. And we think actually that growth is poised to underperform value as we go forward, as these valuations reassert themselves back to something approaching normality.
We have seen a couple of recent flurries in value stocks, little upward trajectories, but it never seems to last. What's it going to take to get a lasting run in this part of the market?
Well, the truth is, Holly, that nobody knows. We have short-term market prices are driven by fashions and emotions and short-term political events. So there's many things that could happen that would hold back prices in the short term. But what we know is that over a long-term investment horizon, the sort of period that people really care about when making investments, that the fair value of an asset, what it's really worth, is the most important thing. And as prices trend towards that fair value, then we'd see these out-of-favor stocks, things like energy and financials and others, will probably do better than these very fashionable stocks in technology.
Okay, theme number two.
Theme number two is a bit controversial. It's active management. We've spoken many times before about how beneficial taking a passive approach can be because the costs are so low. But given the great spread in valuations we're seeing in the market at the moment, we think there are really good opportunities for active managers, whether they're selecting individual companies or managing entire portfolios, to add value in the coming few years in a way they really struggled to do over the last few years. So again, cost is incredibly important. You need to access that active management with the most talented investors as cheap as you possibly can. But we can see that coming back into the fore over the next few years as these active managers are able to select companies or select assets that are out of favor with the possibility of much higher returns.
And I guess it's worth pointing out that doesn't mean throw away all of the passive, all of the tracker funds, but it means strategically choose those areas where active managers can do better.
That's exactly right. Active management is not a one-size-fits-all arrangement. There are some asset classes where it's very difficult for active managers to add value, and some areas where active management is typically really expensive. And so all of that work has to be done before picking an active management. Of course, we've got some fantastic fund analysts at Morningstar that produce research on active and passive managers that might help people. But in the meantime, we can see a renaissance in some areas of active management over the coming few years.
And what is our third and final theme?
So the third theme, I don't think, will surprise anyone, and that is ESG. This seems to be the investment theme that's on top of mind for everyone at the moment, as we're seeing many launches of new ESG products, many articles talking about the ESG style of investment. And while that's likely to continue to be a dominant theme, ESG has become such a broad umbrella term. I think we need to be really careful when choosing an ESG fund that we understand what we're buying, because not all ESG funds, not all ESG strategies are the same. Some are very similar to making a conventional investment. You'll end up owning most of the same stocks in most of the same proportions. Some are very, very different. And so if you're thinking of taking an ESG approach, either firstly, we'd recommend you get advice, but secondly, do your homework, do the research. And that will help guide you towards the right ESG strategy for you.
Dan, thank you so much for your time. For Morningstar, I'm Holly Black.
And lastly, Christine Benz discusses investing apps with Jake Van Kersen from Morningstar, Inc.
In the past year, investing apps have become widely available. Chances are, if you're a regular podcast listener, you know the name of many of these apps, have downloaded them, and used the promo code. The appeal is understandable. You, as an investor, can buy and sell stocks from the convenience of your own phone without having to use a traditional broker. Still, just because you can buy and sell stocks from your own phone, should you? And if you do, what do you need to know?
Well, there are a couple of things that argue against short-term trading. One is that at Morningstar, we have a window into what has led to success and failure for professional money managers. So we have a lot of data on mutual funds. And one commonality among the great fund managers is that most of them are long-term oriented and patient investors. And it stands to reason that as individual investors, we should adopt that same mindset with respect to our portfolios. Another risk of short-term investing, I think, is that kind of a gambler's mentality can set in. If you have luck with one position, you might be inclined to bet bigger or take more risky bets in the future, and those could backfire. And finally, there are taxes to consider. So as a short-term trader, if you have held securities for less than a year and you have gains in them, you'll owe taxes on those gains at your ordinary income tax rate. On the other hand, if you're a longer-term investor and you've held securities for a year or longer, you're eligible for what's called the long-term capital gains rate, which is as low as 0%.
Rather than trying to time the market or get stuck in that gambler's mentality that you talked about, Christine, what is a good way for individuals to evaluate individual stocks?
Well, you really want to focus on two key things. One is the quality of the business, And that means what sustainable competitive advantages does it have relative to other companies that play in that same industry? At Morningstar, we call that a moat. And the other thing you want to focus on is what price the business is selling at. What's the stock price relative to the company's future prospects? And those things go hand in hand, and they both have to be directionally right for it to be a good investment. So even if it's a great company, if it's selling expensively, it may not be a great investment.
So one of the benefits of investing apps is I can put together a portfolio of these individual stocks based on the criteria that you just said. However, that sounds like it's going to get pretty expensive and it would take a lot of time.
It might take a lot of time and money to build a portfolio that's adequately diversified, because if you're putting together a portfolio, you want to think about having holdings that offset one another. So when one holding is going up, maybe you have all the other holdings in your portfolio that are going down. As a smaller investor, it can be really difficult to build that kind of diversification, which is one reason why I would say that for starting investors, a mutual fund or an exchange-traded fund can make a lot of sense, because you can get a lot of diversification without a lot of money, and you won't need to spend a lot of time managing the whole portfolio on an ongoing basis.
So it sounds like getting into a mutual fund would be a great way to just sort of set it and forget it and find a manager that I really like and all that. But I want to be a bit of a contrarian. You have great advice, but I really want to own single stocks. Can you think of any reason why I would do that?
I wouldn't rule out investing in individual stocks, assuming that you've done your homework and you've identified good companies and they're selling at reasonable prices. That could be a decent way to go about building a portfolio. One thing I would say, though, is that if you're holding individual stocks, just pay attention to what else you have in your portfolio, because you want to make sure that they're not redundant with any other holdings, for example, mutual funds or exchange-traded funds.
Thanks, Christine. This technology might give us a chance to jump into the deep end of investing, but it's great to have a swim lesson.
That does it for this week's Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. We hope you have enjoyed our program, and we welcome your feedback. Please send your comments and questions to podcast@morningstar.com. From everyone here at Morningstar, thanks for listening. This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. The podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered tax advice. Please consult a tax and/or financial professional for advice specific to your individual circumstances. Morningstar Research Services, LLC is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analysis, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.